Hey y'all, let's have a meeting. My name is Kat and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker tonight. Her name is Shannon. The one thing that I love about this program is that you get to meet people, you get real friends in this program. And it's not like you did when you were out drinking and using. Shannon has become one of my closest friends. I love her with all my heart. She's an amazing woman, so I hope you enjoy her story tonight. And here she is. Hi, everyone. I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. And there will be a lot of crying tonight. I can promise you that. I do it whether it's something sad or not. So, it's, you know, just ignore it. my sobriety date is December 7th, 2006. I got sober in New Jersey. And I was born in January 19th, 1975 in Pennsylvania. My dad was in the Army. I was born at the Philadelphia Naval Base. And my dad and my mother got divorced when I was about two or three. And, of course, I have no memory of that, but I've heard a lot of stories about what happened, you know, for that to occur. And some of those stories revolved around the fact that my mother was locking me and my sister in closets and going out drinking at night. And her mother actually found us on two different occasions. And my dad filed for divorce, and my mother took off with me and my sister to Florida. My dad came and found us and took us back to Pennsylvania and ended up with custody of us. And when I was about five, he married my stepmother, and so they were both together, the ones that raised me and my sister, and then I have a stepsister and a half-sister, and my poor father. And five women in one house, yeah. It's no wonder he drank. I don't remember a whole lot about my childhood. I do know that there was a lot of instances of things happening to young girls that should not happen to young girls. And there were, my parents would, most days, would not even come home from work. They would go straight to the bar. And and if we wanted anything, then we needed, you know, we had to go to the bar to get it, if we needed money or, you know, whatever. And most of the time we were in bed before they would even come home. And so as I was growing up, you know, drinking was normal. We had it in our house. My parents were always out. There was always parties at the house. And but I didn't really start drinking until I was in my probably early 20s. I had tried a couple times. Like, I'd have a wine cooler and, you know, have one or two. And then I'm like, that's, a, you know, whatever. And then started going out and drinking with friends, and I was drinking like Tom Collins, which is probably the worst drink ever. And I mean, I can only have like one or two, and then my stomach is feeling ill. And I was like, how do people freaking drink this crap? Like, I don't understand why people enjoy alcohol. And so that kept me probably from drinking for a while, because I'm like, I don't even like this stuff. Most of my life, from the time, as far back as I can remember, up till I was about 11, I was told that my natural mother was dead. And my mother is the oldest of seven girls. And so we spent a lot of time, in spite of everything that happened between my mom and dad, we spent a lot of time with my mom's family, like going for summer visits at my aunt's houses, and we stayed very close with my grandmother. And I just remember one day telling her that, I don't know, I was cheerleading or something, and I was like, I wish my mom was here to see this. And she's like, well, what do you mean? And I was like, well, she's dead. And she said, honey, your mom is not dead. She's very much alive, and she would love to see you. And so that followed, you know, after that, there was a phone call. And then about a month or so after that, that Christmas that year, my sister and I went from Pennsylvania, came to Georgia, which she was living down here, and stayed with her for about 3 months. And there were instances that occurred with my stepfather, and next thing I know, we're on a plane going back to Pennsylvania. And I was very angry with my mother for that. You know, I felt like she was choosing him over us. And so I didn't talk to her for a couple years. And I guess the first time that I really, really got drunk, I was probably about 14. And I was out with some friends, two of my girlfriends, and then there was three guys from high school. I knew two of them, and I didn't know the third one. And so my two girlfriends are hooking up with the, you know, two of the guys, and then the other one's trying to hook up with me, and they had beer. I don't like beer, so then they had a fifth of Southern Comfort. And so every time he would try to make a move on me, I'm like, where's the bottle? I want the bottle. And ended up drinking like that whole fifth by myself. And by the time I got home, my dad was sitting in the living room with a friend and my youngest sister, who was about two at the time. And I'm like trying to play it off and talk to them for a minute. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to bed. And I tripped going up the stairs. And my dad's like, Shannon, what is up with you? And I was like, nothing, Dad. I'm just tired. And I went up and I passed out face down on the bed, jean jacket still on, pocketbook over my shoulder. And at some point throughout the night, I got like violently ill in my sleep. I woke up in a puddle of puke, and it was pitch black in my bedroom. So when I woke up, I had to use the bathroom, and I was thinking I was still in this tree fort that we had been in. And I'm feeling around the walls, and I'm like, my girlfriend's name was Barb. I was like, you know, how do I get out of here? And when I finally found my door and opened it and I realized I was home, I was like, crap, I hope I wasn't saying that out loud, because my parents' bedroom was right next to mine. And I was feeling so sick that I went in, went to the bathroom, still covered in puke, didn't even care, went back in, laid right back down in it. The next morning I got up and I was washing myself up and everything. Everybody had left the house, all my sisters, my dad, I don't even know where they all were. Got cleaned up, and I'm sitting on the couch, and I was feeling so horrible. And my dad comes home, and he's like, if you ever come home like that again, you won't have to worry about tripping up the steps, because I'm going to kick your ass all the way up the steps. And I was like, you don't have to worry about that, Dad. I'm never drinking again. And, yeah. So by the time I was 15, I forgave my mother down here. And she had left that husband, and it was her and my brother. They were living down near Augusta. And she was in the military. And so I came back down here to give it another try. And I don't know if that even lasted a year, because by the time I was 16, I was pregnant. And later in that same year, when I was about 8 months pregnant, I got married to someone who was not the baby's father. And we got married when I was 16, had the second baby when I was 17, and then got divorced when I was 18. And still wasn't really drinking. He worked at night, I worked during the day. You know, we had traded off the kids in between. And but the relationship became abusive, and so I had to go. And I moved back to Pennsylvania soon after that. You know, my whole life is like, all right, I'm having problems here, so I have to, you know, I've got to get away from here and, like, move halfway across the country. So I put these two kids in the car in a U-Haul, I'm 18, a one-year-old and two-year-old in a U-Haul packed full of crap, driving by myself from Georgia to Pennsylvania, going the whole time, what the hell was I thinking? And at one point I pulled over to go to sleep on the side of the road, because if I pull into a truck stop, they would wake up and they're like, drive, mommy, drive. And I finally get to close my eyes for 2 seconds, and a Virginia cop is like, tap, tap, tap. You can't park here. You have to go there. And by the time I got to Pennsylvania, I was so exhausted. I, like, literally locked the doors, took the keys out of the ignition, let the kids out of their car seats, and I was like, I closed my eyes. I had to sleep. And but I get to my parents' house. My dad, I move in with my dad and my stepmom. And I started working in a bar up there. And then the bar had an apartment above the bar, so that was just perfect. And so I moved into the apartment and worked in the bar. And then, you know, it was really easy to drink, because then I didn't... At some point in all of this, I had gone to a bartender, and I was like, give me something I'm going to like. You know, because I'm, like, drinking all this other crap, and I don't like any of it. Southern Comfort, I still cannot stand the smell of it to this day. So he gave me a Bacardi and Coke, and that was it for me. Like, that was my drink. And so living above the bar, it was really easy. I could go to work. We were allowed to drink at work. So go to work, get drunk, go home, get paid for it. I mean, you know, it was awesome. And until it wasn't. At some point, before I moved into that apartment, my stepmom, because I didn't have a car at the time, had taken me to this bar for my interview, and there was a guy sitting at the bar and wanted to buy me a drink, and I wasn't even 21 yet, so I was like, I can't. And she's like, we've got to get back home, and she invites this guy back to her house, and I was like, I don't even know this guy. And so we got married. I had, you know, it's me and it's these two babies, and I didn't even know how to take care of myself at that point, much less me and these two babies, and how the heck do I make enough money to support all of us? And, you know, this guy comes along and he's a loser, and you can tell just by looking at him he's a loser. And but he was talking about this $600,000 settlement he was going to be getting, and you know, whatever. But that whole marriage lasted about a year and a half. He was kind enough to introduce me to other forms of alcohol, and you know, and it had gotten to a point where we were feeding the kids peanut butter and crackers for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, because all our money was going for other things. And so, and at that point, you know, I said to him, like, I don't want to do this anymore. And but he kept bringing it home. See, if it wasn't in front of me, like, I didn't care. Like, I didn't go looking for it or whatever, but he'd bring it home and be like, look what I brought home. And then I'm like, well, it's here, might as well do it. And but eventually even that got old, and at one point, finally, I was like, if you bring it home again, I'm calling the cops. And 2 weeks later, I moved out. And he and I had a third baby together, and who was about 6 months old at that time. And so when we separated, he took the six-month-old baby with him, and I had the other two, and we were sharing, you know, custody and visitation. He was supposed to have him for 6 months. I would have him for 6 months. We would share visitation in between. And it went really, really well up until until the youngest son turned five, and then they disappeared. And I didn't know where they were for about 3 years, and then I found them. I think I found his mom or something and called her, and then we went to court, and I agreed to supervised visitation. And I was living in New Jersey. They were living in Pennsylvania. And it was a three-hour drive one way for me to go sit in a McDonald's for 15 to 20 minutes to see my then 8-year-old son, who was so deathly afraid to even spend a minute alone with me that every time I'd say anything about him coming to visit, it was, if my dad can come, if my dad can come. And one day they came to New Jersey, and we were having a great day, took them up on the boardwalk, bought him hermit crabs, his dad supposedly gets a phone call saying his grandfather's going to die, so they had to rush back to Pennsylvania to the hospital. And I said, I'm not going to bother you during this time. Let me know when things settle down so I can come and see my son again. And didn't hear from him. So like 2 weeks later, I tried calling the phone number, and the phone number was disconnected again. And by this time, I'm drinking a lot, because I pretty much went from that relationship into another relationship. Big surprise. And so that husband and I, the third husband and I, you know, we were perfect match. We would sit there and drink a half a bottle of Bacardi a night together, and it was really a terrible marriage, but it lasted about 8 years. And when my son disappeared that second time, though, I was torn between, do I still keep trying to track him down and, you know, come into his life and then have his dad rip him out again, and or do I just like let it go, and when he's old enough to find me, he'll find me. And I kind of went back and forth between doing those, both of those, over the years, you know, trying to find him and then being like, okay, well, I moved down here. I got divorced when I was 28, and then by that time, the two older boys had already gone to live with their fathers, and so it was the first time ever I was on my own with no kids, no husband, no parents, and I discovered girlfriends and bars and hanging out and, you know, all the fun single stuff that single people do, because, you know, I didn't have any of that experience. I was pretty much married from the time I was 16 to 28, and it was really fun for about 3 years. And then it had gotten to the point where I had drank myself so bad, so sick, that I had lost control of all my bodily functions. I couldn't put a complete thought together in my head, much less have a sentence come out of my mouth. And I, in spite of everything else, I was more afraid that I gave myself wet brain than I was anything else. And so I detoxed for about 3 days in my apartment by myself, literally crawling to the bathroom. I had no experience to know that there was really a such thing as treatment centers. But after about 3 or 4 days of that, I was starting to feel at least well enough to be able to stand up without throwing up. And so I got my phone book out, and I called the 800 number for AA, and I found the nearest meeting was 20 minutes away, and I got in my car still shaking, still sick as a dog, and went to the meeting, and I sat in the back of the room. I didn't hear a word that was said that entire meeting. I was bawling my eyes out like crazy, and afterwards this woman came up to me, and she just gave me a hug, and she just said, you never have to feel this way again. And so I kept coming back, and that time around I was in the program for about 4 months, and I got a sponsor, and I was working the steps, and that sponsor was going back and telling my then boyfriend everything I was telling her, and that had nothing to do with me leaving the program, though. I decided after 4 months that now that I know what's wrong with me, you know, I could drink and not be as bad as I was before. Now, mind you, in all of this too, you know, my whole time growing up, going through school, high school, whatever, I never felt like I belonged. We moved a lot when I was little. I felt I was picked on a lot. I was like the ugly duckling, and so a lot of insecurity and a lot of just feeling like I didn't matter. And so when So I went back out and experimented a little bit more, and it lasted about 6 months, and I didn't get as bad as I was that first time I had come in, but I saw myself heading that way, and so I was like, I don't want to do this. I didn't want to come back to meetings either, because if I can't trust my sponsor, then, you know, how am I supposed to share meetings? How am I supposed, you know, whatever. And it took me a long time to get over that. I knew that if I didn't do this, then I was going to die. And but I also wanted to drink really, really bad. So I kind of made a promise to myself that I would come to meetings, and I would give it my all. I would get into service work. I would chair meetings. I would, you know, have a sponsor. I would work the staffs. I would sponsor people. And if I still felt like I wanted to drink after 90 days, then I was going to go drink. And lucky for me, at some point during that time period, and I would go to meetings and cry and bang on the table, and because I was freaking angry. And I was like, I don't want to be here. I hate all you people. luckily, at some point in that 90 days, there was a shift, and that feeling went away. And that was December 7th, 2006. I was still in New Jersey. I worked in a bar for the first 11 months of my sobriety. I was a bartender. But I had worked at that same bar for 12 years, and so by the time I was getting sober, I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I could not drink, and so it didn't really affect me to be there and around other people that were. You know, it's probably not a good place for an alcoholic to be working. People would offer me drinks, and I'm like, no thanks, I'm not drinking today. And they're like, are you feeling okay? It wasn't until I got to be like 30 days sober, because, you know, that was a huge deal that I could even get 30 days sober. Because in my third marriage, we would fight a lot. And so for me to prove to him that he was the one with with the problem, that he was the alcoholic, not me, I would quit drinking for weeks, maybe even a month at a time. And I would mark on the calendar each day that I did not drink. And, you know, it started out where if I didn't drink that day, I'd put the mark on the calendar at night. Well, when I started, like, you know, after a few days, you start that white knuckling. You're like, I really want to fucking drink. And so I started putting the check mark on the calendar in the morning, because if the check mark's already there, then I really can't drink that day. And it would work for a couple weeks, and then I'm like, well, now I can celebrate, because I didn't drink for, you know, a couple weeks, month, whatever. And, that never went well either. Never ended up well. But, so I moved down here. I was about 11 months sober. At 10 months sober, I had the wonderful opportunity to go to Hazelden in Minnesota. And I went out there for a week-long retreat on coping with anger, jealousy, and resentment through forgiveness. And it was probably one of the best weeks of my life, you know. And it also helped me, it just gave me more of a foundation, I think, with my program. I worked the steps with my sponsor. When she made me get on this floor and on my knees and do the third step prayer, it felt really, really awkward. And I was like, she said the prayer. I didn't really know the prayer yet all that well. But then afterwards, I guess the meaning behind it kind of sunk in. And I was starting to feel a little change, but then I was also terrified because next was the fourth step. And I made my list of everybody that made me angry, that has done me wrong, and I had found a list. You know, I did it the big book way. Well, I did it two ways. I really, at first, I just wrote my entire life story out, and because that was just easier for me. Putting a list together was just like, that was, there's not enough detail there. And and I did do the list, the person I'm mad at, what they did, you know, what it affected in me, you know, was that jealousy, whatever. And then I was told to add a fourth column, and what would God have me do instead? And that was very helpful for me, too, in dealing with the forgiveness part and also seeing my part in it because, you know, in a lot of those situations, maybe I reacted badly or, you know, maybe I just even unknowingly provoked it to begin with when I really got honest about it. And so that helped me work through a lot of that. And then when I did my fifth step with my sponsor, I felt like the world lifted off my shoulders, you know, because all that guilt, shame, and remorse that we come in here with, and you know, when I first got here and I'd be in meetings and people are sharing about some of the stuff that I had done that I was never going to say out loud, and they're laughing about it and things like that, and it helped me be able to see that, you know, yes, I did these things, and yes, they're ridiculous, and you know, but I have a disease, and that disease causes me to do these things if I'm drinking, and it helps, you know, start lifting away that guilt and that shame, and allowed me to be able to say it out loud and to use that to help other women in the program, especially, I've been through a few book studies. There's a book, I don't know if it's AA approved, but it's on the 6 and 7 steps, and, you know, teaches you all about your character defects. And it's, when you're doing it in a group, it's kind of interesting, because you're, like, supposed to be pointing out your own character defects, but it doesn't always go that way. But it's eye-opening, and it's, and I probably should do it again because, you know, it's been a while. But I love doing groups with women. I've gone through a couple, like, small groups with women, and we're doing, like, a journey through the 12 steps and things like that. And because you get other insights, you're working the steps with other people. And, you know, we all had sponsors, but then we're doing this at the same time. And it was... it helps you become closer with people in the program and get to know them better, and also helps you stay sober, or help me stay sober anyway. When I was about 7 years sober, 2014 was an awful, awful year for me. So I had, my last divorce was when I was 28. 2013, I decided it would be a good idea to get married again. And to someone who I dated 6 months, we broke up twice in that 6 months. And but hey, whatever. And so we got married in November. I filed for divorce in January, and probably the shortest marriage ever. And so that was already rough. I'm going through that. And then I had my middle son and my youngest son living with me at the time. And my middle son was in his early 20s, other son, late teens. And they're using and dealing drugs out of my house. And so I'm, like, dealing with this divorce. I'm dealing with the kids doing this. And it got to the point where I told them that I was moving. We had 4 months before our lease was up. I'm like, I am moving. You are not coming with me. I'm going to a little one-bedroom apartment. You wouldn't fit anyway. And you've got 4 months to figure out what you're going to do. They both had jobs, you know. And I was in therapy at the time, and my therapist is like, you know, you can't run away from your problems. She's like, but you've got to get away from them for a little bit, put some distance there. So I ended up moving into the new apartment 2 months early, and paying rent on two places for the 2 months just to have peace in my life again. And I was moving, some more of my stuff, because I had a whole 2 months, so it was all going in like shifts. And I had just dropped off a load, took the U-Haul truck back, and I was on my way back home, and I stopped at Walgreens, and I get a phone call from my oldest son's father, and he's crying, and I was like, what is the matter? And I was like, he was going through a divorce, so I thought maybe it was something with that. And he tells me that our son hung himself. And I was numb. Like, I couldn't even respond, because I was like, So he's going on and on, and he's apologizing and all this other stuff, and I'm like, it wasn't your fault. I'm like, stop apologizing. And I said, but I'm in Walgreens right now. I said, can I call you back? And he's like, yes, I just wanted you to know what happened. And I had quit smoking a few weeks before that. And I hung up the phone. I literally sat on the floor in the middle of Walgreens, and I just lost it. And I had, like, hair color or something in my hand. I had products in my hand that I had before this phone call. And I don't know why I didn't just, like, drop them somewhere, but I take them up to the front counter, and there's this poor woman up there, and she's like, are you okay? Because I'm crying hysterically. And I was like, yeah. I was like, and I tell her about this phone call, because, you know, it's, like, really fresh. And she's like, oh, my goodness, you can't drive. So she's like, let me drive you home. And I was like, no, I'll be okay. And I go to the counter. I pay for whatever was in my hand, and I was like, give me 2 packs of Marlboro Red 100s. So I went and I sat in my car and called some family, and, until I was calmed down at least enough to make it home. And I called my sponsor, and she was like, she said, I'm coming over there. She's like, I'm 3 hours away because I'm on vacation. She said, but I'm coming down there. And I was like, no, you don't need to do that. I was like, I'll be okay. And she goes, no, she said, I'm going to make a few phone calls, and if nobody else can come be with you, I'm coming back down there. Next thing I know, 7 people from my home group show up at my door, and they sat with me, for a while that night and everything, and made sure I was okay. And and in the beginning, a lot of it was I had to go to Pennsylvania and for the services and things like that. Now, my son had a son who was getting ready to turn 2. And so, if it was either of my other 2 children, I might have been able to understand it more, because I knew about their struggles with addiction and the things that they were going through. My oldest son lived in Pennsylvania, so I was kind of removed from that, although I had feelings that he might be one of us. And but his father has no experience with addiction or any of that, and was in, I think, denial. But when I went up there the first time, the whole top of my son's dresser is just nothing but liquor bottles, but he had, he's got this baby, and he just started a new job, and this and that and the other thing, and everything seemed like it was going in a good direction for him, there was a house full of people, so I just, none of it made any sense. And when I got that call first thing the next morning, my first instinct was to go to a meeting. So I went to Triangle, and I shared about it, and I kept going to meetings, after that, and I would share about it. But it was all I could talk about, and it was, and so it got to the point where I felt like people were tired of hearing me talk about it. And during that time too, probably not surprisingly, that's the most I wanted to drink in the whole 7 years that I had been sober. And I hadn't wanted, it was like the obsession was on me. And but my ego probably saved my life, because I was like, if I drink over this, number one, it's not going to bring my son back. number two, then I lose the ability to tell other people that if I can stay sober through this freaking shit, you can stay sober through anything. And so in the last two, he died June 21st of 2014. And so I've made meetings kind of sporadically. I was in therapy, you know, getting outside help and stuff like that. And I spent most of 2015 selling off everything I owned and buying all kinds of backpacking gear because I was going to go hike the Appalachian Trail this year, or in 2016. And, you know, God works in mysterious ways because my stepmother emails me and says, we want to come live with you. And so she spent most of 2015 in the hospital to the point where by October, they did not expect her to leave. And so my sisters and I have a sister in Indiana. I'm here. My other sisters were up there. We all show up at the hospital. She wakes up to us all standing around. We're going, what are you doing here? And my dad and I got her out of the hospital the day before Thanksgiving that year. And she miraculously, and very much so to the doctor's surprise, you know, she made it through that. She had MRSA. She had sepsis. She had, like, the poor woman went through everything. And so I get this phone call this email in January. And so I'm like, okay. So I move out of the one-bedroom apartment, go get a two-bedroom apartment, handicap accessible, buy all new furniture, and get everything ready for them to come down in May. But it was kind of a godsend because, you know, having them there and having for me to have something else to focus on, you know, kind of got me out of the depression that I was in over my son. And and because I stayed sober through it all, I have the ability to be there and to help them, you know, when they needed it most. So they came down here May of 2016. She did really well. She didn't have to go in the hospital again till October. Was her first round, and then she had to go back in January, and then she just went in February 20th, last month, and March 2nd, my sisters all came to town from Indiana, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, and we made the decision to take her off of life support. And she passed away this past Monday. Which, you know, of course it hurts. She was my stepmom. She raised us. But at the same time, she was in so much pain for so long, you know, that, you know, it's also a blessing. But, and so now I get to take care of my dad through all of this, too. And 10 years ago, you know, I couldn't take care of myself. I couldn't take care of a worm in a bag. You know? And so, although my meetings were, you know, sporadic over the last 2.5 years, before I started, you know, really getting involved in meetings again, I was still keeping in touch with my network, and I still, you know, I would make meetings when I could. The therapist I had was knowledgeable in addiction and grief. And so, you know, that helped a lot. And I knew that eventually I would come back to meetings. But, you know, in the very beginning, especially when it was really raw, it's like every meeting I came to, somebody was talking about suicide, somebody was talking about death, and I couldn't. Or they were talking about traffic on the way to work. You know, they're having a bad day because traffic on the way to work. And I couldn't sit here and listen to it. I wasn't strong enough at that point. And every meeting since I've come back, it's been suicide and death. And I'm a little better with dealing with it now. At least I'm not breaking down and running out of the meetings. But after that initial, like, craving, and once I got past that, that wanting to drink really, really bad, you know, it luckily it hasn't come back yet. it taught me, you know, it doesn't matter how long you're sober, it can certainly, like, you know, you can take a few steps backwards. And even, you know, coming in when I first, and even now really, but coming back to meetings and everything, like, I almost feel like a newcomer all over again. And, because when you're dealing with all the emotional stuff, it kind of feels the same. So, but I know this program works, and I know having a network works. I know having a sponsor works, even if you don't call her every day. And the promises, you know, that they talk about, they really do come true if you work it. And I, you know, during that time, I no longer work in a bar. I went to school. I'm now a paralegal. I have my two younger children. One lives in Augusta, one's in Pennsylvania, and then I have two grandsons. And one is five, and the other will be two this year. One will be five this year, the other will be two this year. And they are definitely the lights of my life right now. My older grandson also has a brother and sister, so I say I have two grandchildren and then two more by proxy. And because I'm sober today, and because I can somewhat control my reactions to certain things, I get to have a relationship with them. I don't know, this program, good or, you know, whether I'm having a good day, bad year, because like I said, 2014 just really sucked, and I hope I never have another year that bad again, but there were things that occurred even in that year that if I had taken a drink, if I decided to drink, like, you know, maybe I wouldn't have a relationship with my five-year-old grandson now. You know, and I definitely wouldn't be able to take care of my parents. I wouldn't be able to keep the job that I have, you know. And I mean, I've kept a job for over 3 years, y'all. That's a record for me. But yeah, I'm very excited to be back in meetings and you know, kind of jumping back in the middle of the bed. I have a home group. It's a Common Solution for Women, the women's meeting here on Thursday nights. I have a sponsor, and I'm sponsoring other women too. And so, and then just also trying to, like, really get back into my program, and because that's where the relief comes from. You know, all this grief, all the, you know, pain and resentment and all of that I've taken on in the last couple years. You know, I got rid of it all before, and then it just, like, all new stuff. So now I get to work through all of that again. But I'm excited to do that because I know what happens when you come out the other side. So, anyway, that's all I got.
Thank you, Shannon. I love you.
Isn't she great, y'all?
Shannon has asked Mike to give out a chip.
Hi, everybody. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
Wow. Once again, you made me cry. Just a testament to the power of this program you are. It's freaking amazing. What you're going to do in the years to come for other people, I can't even imagine.
Thank you.
That's to give out the chips. In Atlanta and other parts of the country, I'm told that we have a chip system. It measures our time, not necessarily our progress in the program. And if you're just coming in, or I'll go through them and then I'll hand them out. If you're just coming in or coming back, we offer you a white chip. If you got 30 days and 30 nights, we offer you a silver. 90 days a red. 6 months of yellow, 9 months of green, and for years or multiples thereof, we offer you a blue. Anybody here tonight like to join our way of life tonight and pick up a white chip? You did that. You. Anybody else would like to pick up a white chip tonight? Anybody got 30 days? Just wait. Just wait. Anybody got 90 days? 6 months? Anybody got 9 months? Anybody has a birthday or a year that we... Why'd you do it?
Because I didn't want to die.
Hey, y'all, I'm Ashley. I'm an alcoholic. This is two. I didn't believe that the first year is a gift shit until I got into my second year. First year is a gift. But this year has been really important to me because I didn't have that happy pink cloud where I felt like I could do nothing wrong and nothing bad could happen to me because I had found sobriety. I had to make some tough decisions this year, but the good thing about this year was really knowing that I have a super fantastic sober network of amazing women that have my back through everything. And in terms of how I did it, I don't really have any new information for everyone, which is great because it means that everything we need to know really is in that book. What I did is I got a home group that I'm very active in. I chair meetings. I'm the alternate GSR. I will be rotating into GSR way too soon. I sponsor women, and I have a sponsor, and a woman that I sponsor now sponsors women, which blows my mind. I pick up the phone when people call. I talk to newcomers. I do all the things that the book tells me to do. I follow suggestions. And the more I don't want to do something, the more that I make myself do it, because I found for me that if my body and if my mind is telling me, you don't need to go to a meeting, you don't need to pick up the phone, you don't need to call your sponsor, you don't need to do that, that's not actually my brain. That's my disease talking to me. So I just try every day to do the best that I can. Some days are better than others, but my worst day in sobriety is so much better than my best day when I was drinking. So I'm really grateful to be here. I'm really grateful to have heard your story, Shannon. That was, I don't even have words, that was amazing. I'm really grateful to be at NABA. This was my very first meeting ever, Wednesday night, 8 o'clock, March 10th, 2015. I was a sobbing mess, and I don't think I'd showered in 3 days, and you guys hugged me. So I'm happy to be here, and to all the newcomers, just keep coming back. Thank you.
Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
I'm a plane in your sky. Without you, I cannot fly. You left me up and put me back together. I'm light as a feather again. You're a shepherd, I'm a stray. You're the star that lights my way, and I will follow. Thank you.